Just a note, for the purpose of this sermon, I will use the terms Native American and Indian interchangeably, as these people of color do themselves. On the tours of First Parish in Concord that I give to teenagers from churches across the country 6 or 7 times a year, I like to start across the street at the top of the hill in the old burying ground. Not only does it get teenagers' attention to walk them through an old graveyard, the top of the hill affords a wonderful view of the current church building and of the town center. If you haven't been up there, I urge you to go and check it out. It also marks the site of the original church building our Puritan ancestors built when they moved out here from Boston in the fall of 1635. From the top of the hill, the story of how our town was founded plays out below. A story of noble intentions and ignoble acts. A story of religious freedom and a story of cultural imperialism and racial prejudice. The teens listen intently as I describe how the Reverend Peter Bulkley, a wealthy British clergyman, led 12 families down Native American paths to the spot on which they stand. The story of the founding of this first inland town in New England, the arriving of white people. In this story of the founding of the first inland town in New England, the arriving white people are impressed by the amount of cleared land they found here. They see the potential for fields and orchards. They recognize it will be less work to stop here and to begin their town. They give no thought to the fact that they are standing on Indian lands, cleared by Indians, cultivated by Indians, claimed by Indians. Our Puritan ancestors have a piece of paper that says the land is theirs. 6 square miles purchased from the female chief of the greatly decimated tribe now subsisting over near Egg Rock. The hill offered high ground upon which to build the first church. It also made shallow dugout houses along its edge possible, so that they could survive that first hard winter. Its trees provided timber for buildings, and its easy digging facilitated the first English graves. Come spring, a new dam on the creek would provide a pond, cleared land would be planted in crops, and Indian neighbors would be warily traded with. The town would be founded in Concord, but there was no doubt who had the upper hand. The invasion of North and South America by Europeans was inevitable. Yes, the Vikings had been on the shores of Massachusetts as early as 1399, but no European settlement stuck here before the founding of Plymouth in 1620. And even that was late in the game. Columbus had famously discovered the West Indies in 1492, and by 1520, Cortez had fully conquered Mexico. It would take another 100 years after the fall of Mexico City before England would gain a foothold in New England, and then only very haphazardly. If Puritans had not been fleeing England for religious reason, and if England hadn't been perfectly glad to get rid of them, it's hard to say who might have been attracted to New England's unforgiving climate and rocky soil. Islands in the Caribbean grew sugarcane and pineapples. Virginia and Carolina grew tobacco and cotton. Good trapping and fishing were about all New England had going for it. And to make matters worse, there was no ready workforce here. Catholic Spaniards and Portuguese enslaved the native populations of the Caribbean and Central and South America. Dutch and English colonists in the South and the Mid-Atlantic owned black slaves. The Puritans arrived in New England with little more than their high-minded ideals. They came here believing theirs was a superior religion. Unlike Catholics who worked to convert the natives they encountered, our Puritan ancestors believed Native Americans were savages and were incapable of becoming fully Christian. So they were relieved when smallpox and other European illnesses killed native peoples by the thousands. Decimated Indian tribes meant more land easily taken. It is possible that the native peoples may have been far enough inland to have avoided direct trade and contact for the first few decades of the 17th century, writes John Hanson Mitchell in his book, Ceremonial Time, 15,000 years on one square mile. But after 1620, he says, and especially after the establishment of the Massachusetts Bay Colony a few years later, they would have felt the presence of the white man and may have even seen a few in the flesh. Then in 1635, the first inland settlement was established at Concord. The land was either traded, sold, or otherwise turned over to some of the English by Tatawahan and the female chief Sachem, two powerful sagamores who owned the area. Now, it would be easy to write a sermon decrying the treatment of Native Americans by our religious ancestors and the stealing of native lands. That's an easy sermon to write. You've probably heard it before. Much harder is to write a sermon that reflects seriously on the spiritual gifts and challenges of belonging to a congregation whose prominent property sits squarely on Indian fields. Who are we modern-day Unitarian Universalists inhabiting the towns around Egg Rock? And what are we doing to recognize our complicated inheritance? Those of us who attended General Assemblies of the Unitarian Universalist Association from roughly 1999 to 2004 will remember the presence of representatives from local Native American tribes from whatever city in which the General Assembly was meeting. Chippewa, Sioux, Mandan. These representatives would come on stage during the opening ceremonies, and the UUA moderator would apologize to them for white people taking their lands. She would then ask their permission to hold the General Assembly there. This ceremony was well-meaning, but terribly awkward. We looked foolish, and the Indians left convinced that we were the nuttiest white people they had ever met. This ritual disappeared after one particularly awkward General Assembly where the Native American representative said, "I don't know why I'm here." And it never reappeared. In the years since, we have grown as a denomination in our approach to facing issues that people of color wrestle with. We've become much more nuanced in our approach to history, and there is still some acknowledging that we UUs need to do. We're on the path, but we need to keep going. There's no doubt that First Parish's religious ancestors mistreated the Native Americans they found here. As long as it was legal to do so, the ministers of this very church owned slaves. Irish railroad workers in Concord were forced to live in shacks along the train tracks running near Thoreau's cabin. And it has taken Concord until last year, almost four centuries, to elect a woman as its town moderator. From the very founding of this town and church, inequality has been present, and it likely will always be so in one way or another. And growth and change are possible individually and collectively, but we have to want to change, you and me. First, we have to set aside our pride of place and our fear of the other. In a similar way that people idealize Concord, they idealize my home state of Montana. When people learn that I grew up on a ranch in Montana, their eyes get big and they exclaim, "How wonderful that must have been." It was wonderful. In its idealized state, Montana is mountains and sky and wild animals and natural beauty. But the Montana that I know is a grim place as well. I have seen firsthand its lack of good jobs, its childhood poverty, its soaring alcoholism, its intolerant politics, and its deadly racism. I love my home state, but I do not idealize it. Growing up in my white-dominated hometown, the only people of color I ever saw were Native Americans. And since my hometown is not on a reservation, the only reason I even saw Indian kids was because their fathers were incarcerated. You see, Deer Lodge, Montana's chief employer is the Montana State Penitentiary. And while all its guards are white, fully half of its inmates are Native American men. The Cons kids, as we called them, were some of the poorest residents of my hometown and some of the most despised. Unstable homes led to fights at school and poor academic performance. Neither I nor my friends tried to understand these kids. We just avoided them. And we built up our prejudices against all Indians in the process. To this day, the racism that overtakes me the quickest is against Native Americans. My roots drank from this poisoned stream. I will likely never fully overcome my knee-jerk prejudice. In his book, The Meeting House on the Green, Dana McLean Greeley wrote in 1985, "In the beginning, the founding of Concord was a real adventure." Quoting the church's longest-standing minister, Ezra Ripley, Greeley affirms, "It was scarcely, if any, less adventurous or perilous in Peter Bulkley's day to come from Cambridge to Concord than from Holland to Plymouth in 1620. But come they did," Greeley continues, "and the Indians' Musketaquid became their Concord, a place of peace." Thirty years ago, we could get away with this kind of Eurocentric take on the founding of this church, but that does not work in 2017. We cannot pretend everything we enjoy was just waiting for us here in 1635. We cannot pretend our history does not still produce ill effects for all who live in the greater Concord area. The legacy of a wealthy white minister founding First Parish in Concord on claimed Native American fields lives with us to this day. It is part of this congregation's DNA. I say this not to make us feel guilty. I don't think guilt does an ounce of good. I say this not to make us feel guilty, but to wake us up. To wake us up to the part that we continue to play in the perpetuation of white supremacy. Long gone are those native peoples living at the confluence of the Sudbury and the Assabet rivers in 1635. But their arrowheads and fish hooks and pot shards are still here. Our children play on the fields they cleared, just as their children played there centuries ago. Their native names grace our street signs. People canoe by Egg Rock on nice days. The people are gone, but their memory is not. We, you and I, have a sacred duty to remember what our religious ancestors did here and to soften its present impact. We have a sacred duty to care for the earth and the air and the water present here even before the native peoples. We have a sacred duty to remember that we are just the current occupants of this land. We have a sacred duty to see today's poverty and injustice, never forgetting we ourselves have not earned what we enjoy. When I stand with the teenagers on the hill across the street, surrounded by the graves of our white religious ancestors, I make a point of telling them First Parish in Concord would not be where it is if it were not for Native Americans. I make a point of telling them that it was the Indians who kept our ancestors alive that first winter by augmenting their poor food supplies. I make a point of telling them that if it were not for Native Americans and African Americans and indentured servants and immigrants, neither Concord nor our church would be as it is. As we walk down out of the old burying ground, I point toward Egg Rock, shrouded by tall leafy trees and bathed on three sides by water. I look there myself and wonder what looks back at me. As we walk down to the former fields below, I make a small bow in remorse and humble gratitude. I know that I cannot make this thing right, but I can help stop the injustice of today. So be it. Amen.